It's Wednesday, February 3rd. Welcome to Market Foolery. I'm Mark Reith, and joining me in studio today from Million Dollar Portfolio, Jason Moser, and from Stock Advisor Canada, Taylor Muckerman. Gentlemen, the Monday crew on a Wednesday.
Hey,
I don't understand.
It's Groundhog Day yesterday. We got to repeat it.
It's fantastic.
I like to think it's just backed by popular demand.
Yeah,
people, whether it's a groundhog or the sun or the spring, whatever, somebody out there likes us. So
it's got to be.
Well, they're not kicking us off.
Myself.
Yeah, not yet. Not yet, at least.
Still have a job.
Speaking of jobs, sometimes this job can be pretty tough as we dig through the news and the markets looking for topics to discuss. Sometimes it's really, really easy. Today was one of those easy days. Earnings continue to pour in from companies like Yahoo, GM, National Oil Well, Varco, and more. But since Jason Moser is in the house, we need to start with Chipotle. And Jason, let's put you on the record right now. I have a tweet from you the other day about Chipotle, and I quote, "Chipotle management needs to go conservative route on today's call. Expectations for 2016 seem too high. Give us a dip. We'll buy it." So my question is, of course, was Chipotle's management call too conservative, just conservative enough, or not conservative enough for you?
You know, we should actually set up a Twitter poll and have people vote.
Yeah, like
we could get the people's feedback. I think that ultimately I think they did a good job on the call and setting expectations wisely. I mean, going into we knew that this was going to be just a brutal quarter, the fourth quarter, and that certainly, you know, by every measure was a brutal quarter. But I think, you know, management on the call, they did not lay out expectations for 2016, at least in the form of guidance. You know, they weren't telling us what they expect on the sales side, the earnings side. They give us sort of a bigger picture. They understand that 2016 is more or less going to be a wash. It's going to be an investment year for the business and really a way for them to try to recover, I don't want to say just the ding to the reputation, but I mean, I guess that's really what it is, right?
It is.
I mean, Chipotle's reputation really took a big hit this past year, and they, you know, I think that this year, 2016, is going to teach us a lot about the kind of staying power that this business really has.
Mm.
Now, I personally, and we in Million Dollar Portfolio, taking, you know, the longer term outlook here, thinking about this as a holding that we want to own for 3 to 5 years, even longer, hopefully, we believe that they will be able to recover from this. I think that, you know, the key there is that you have a founder leader in Steve Ells, who has a lot tied personally to this business, and then a great operator, honestly, in Monty Moran. I think they make a wonderful, co-CEO team there. But with that said, I mean, it's not going to be just like, okay, well, everybody likes Chipotle burritos, and 2015 was a tough year, but 2016 will be better. I mean, 2015, that fourth quarter, revenue fell about 7%. Comps were down almost 15%, about 14.6%. And anytime you see restaurant traffic like that fall, those comp sales, because those are stores that have been open for at least a year, they tend to bring in more reliable, more robust sales, which then carries down to the bottom line, right? There are a lot of fixed costs in keeping those restaurants open. So the more traffic they can gin up, the more profitable they are.
Right.
And you know, the opposite of that is what we see in the deleveraging, where, you know, it's less traffic and really, it, you know, they're not making nearly as much money. If you just think about it in simplest terms, say it costs $100 to keep the restaurant open for the day, and you're doing $100 in sales, well, you're basically just covering your costs.
Mm.
If it costs $100 to keep the restaurant open and you're doing $500 in sales, well, then you can see you're immensely profitable there. And so they are witnessing right now, you know, the former in those two scenarios. And what they need to do is figure out a way to get traffic back into the stores. And I think ultimately they will because they're working hard at it. But they're also going to open up a bunch of stores this year. We thought they were going to probably take a little bit more of a conservative route this year on the store openings. They're going to open somewhere in the neighborhood of 230 stores this coming year.
Right.
And that, I think, is encouraging because if they can convince customers to come back over the course of the year, those new stores will also serve as a good top-line driver as well. So I still think, you know, this is a quality business. I don't think it's impaired beyond recognition. I think it's going to take a while for them to bring it back. But I do think 2016 will be a good year for investors to build a position in what we still think is an excellent business.
Well, that was actually kind of my next question. Taylor, maybe you can take this one. So Chipotle, we've been watching it and talking about it for a long time because it's been this amazing, you know, growth story. We've just watched this, you know, rocket take off into the stratosphere. Now it's hitting this huge roadblock, if I can mix my idioms for a second.
Sure.
It, weirdly, a lot of people have been getting into Chipotle because of its momentum, because of its growth. Now it's stalling. Maybe 2016, we're going to see a big old decline as they continue to spend so much money to try to get these customers back. But it's still not cheap enough in my mind to be a value investment at this point. It's still a $440 per share company. Mm-hmm. It's still got some great ratios out there. So I guess my question is, Taylor, in your mind, where does Chipotle stand in the spectrum of investments? Is it a growth company still? Is it a value company at this point? Is it just going to putter along through 2016 and we're going to have to wait until 2017 to answer this question?
I think it's a better value of a growth company than it was just a few months ago. It's still growing, obviously, 200 some odd stores opening this year.
Yeah.
And the stock has really only taken a hit because of an outbreak of the norovirus. Mm-hmm. So it's not that business was slowing, so the results suffered. It's just a freak accident that took place across several of their stores, unfortunately, but it seems that they've gotten it taken care of. So I still think this is a growth story, maybe it just a better value than it was now. So you can mix the terms, but I still think it's a growth stock.
Jason?
Yeah, if you have to look at Chipotle, before all of this happened, it was doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
So there were no problems there. This is kind of like what Taylor was saying there. It's sort of a one-off event, or we hope it's a one-off event. If it's not, then they got bigger problems. But ultimately, it is something where as long as they can bring traffic back in, they have somewhere in the neighborhood of 2,000 restaurants open today now. I got an interesting question on Twitter from Todd Mantell, who said he asked, "I'm concerned that they're not moving aggressively with ShopHouse. Having eaten there, I think they have a big market opportunity." And I think Todd's point is a good one. ShopHouse, for those of us who have eaten there, have you eaten there?
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Have you?
I have not.
So
no.
I've eaten there. I thought it was really good.
It's tasty.
I think it's a great alternative. And I do think there is a big market opportunity there. They have like 13 of those stores open today. Mm-hmm. And every quarter they've told us before any of this happened. Every quarter they've kind of told us the same thing, in that they see opportunity there with ShopHouse. They see opportunity there with Pizzeria Locale, which is even smaller at this point. But that those are just really seeds right now. They're ideas. They're learning as they grow. But for the foreseeable future, the source of growth for this business is going to be the namesake Chipotle stores. And so, I agree with Todd in that they do have a huge market opportunity there. But I also think that, given what they've gone through here, and also let's remember, this isn't all completely resolved yet. They're dealing with a federal investigation,
right,
a nationwide investigation that they're going to have to resolve as well. I think it would appear if they were taking their eyes off the ball here to focus on another concept, that could come back and bite them,
right,
and not fully addressing the problems that they've had in their supply chain with the namesake stores. And they'll take learnings from this and bring those learnings over to ShopHouse and Pizzeria Locale. And I think that's another attractive part of the stock, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is going to be, I think there is a lot of room for this company to still grow over the course of the next 10 to 20 years. I think realistically, we look at investments and think of them in 3 to 5 year timelines. This is one where there still is a very, very long road of growth available if they continue to execute. And it was worth noting too, in the call, they mentioned the ShopHouse concept and Pizzeria Locale exactly zero times.
Hmm.
Normally they're brought up in the calls, but in this call they weren't even mentioned, and so you could tell where management's focus is, and I think that's right.
Right. Okay. Let's keep on moving on with National Oil Well Varco, which on Wednesday posted a pretty hefty loss for the last 3 months. Taylor, you are a resident oil expert, least in this room.
Loosely,
sure.
Yes,
yeah, why
loosely.
Not? National Oil Well Varco, like all the other oil companies out there, has been suffering as just oil prices continue to plummet. What's
yes.
what's a barrel worth these days?
In
the 30s?
Less than 30 yesterday, I believe. I don't know what's happening with it today, but it dipped below 30 again
right.
yesterday.
And it just seems unfair for National Oil Well Varco, which as a lot of fools around here really like. It's a really good company,
mm-hmm.
At least in my opinion, and a lot of fools' opinions. But you just see it getting slammed by the situation surrounding it. What can National Oil Well Varco do about that, if anything?
Yeah, I don't think there's anything that they really can do. And if there's some way that they can disrupt the supply of oil, then that's their best bet.
Sure.
But I don't see that happening anytime soon other than just providing a bunch of faulty equipment. But that wouldn't be good for the long term.
Mm-hmm.
What they have done so far They've managed costs. They've worked with some of their customers to reduce the prices that they're charging, maybe putting some of these things on, I don't know, on layaway or whatever, that they're just allowing them different payment terms just to kind of keep the revenue streams going. But revenue is down 52% year over year, 18% quarter over quarter. That being said, balance sheet is still very strong. So Tyler Crow, a Fool writer that people might recognize as an energy analyst on our free site, he actually spoke with Clay Williams, the CEO of National Oil of Arco a few months ago. And he didn't come out explicitly and say, this is where we're looking, this is what we're going to do. But you got a sense that they're looking to buy some more companies. This is a company that has historically been very acquisitive. Mm-hmm. Nothing too big and splashy, just continual tack-on acquisitions. So that's something that I could see them doing because they have the cash to do it and the size to do it, and they have the history of being able to do it successfully. So I would imagine sometime this year, investors are going to see them snap some people up.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, actually. I was just doing the research before this segment. It turns out they made 7 very small acquisitions mm-hmm. this past year, which I was a little surprised by, mm-hmm. given, again, the state of the oil industry.
Right.
So, yeah, I guess they are just still following through with that acquisitive, you know, plan of theirs. But to your point earlier, the real problem lies in that all the equipment that they have is just kind of lying around at this
sure.
point. No one's buying it because no one's digging for oil because there's already so much on the market. And then you see them get dinged with these $1.63 billion pre-tax impairment charge, which, if you wouldn't mind explaining what an impairment charge is in a moment.
Yep.
Can National Oil of Arco get rid of those assets? Can they just try to sell them for the cheap? Is that the best business plan here? Where does National Oil of Arco go from here?
So first, the impairment charge is basically if the carrying value of these assets on their balance sheet is higher than what they could maybe sell them outright for or the future cash flow streams mm-hmm. would earn. So they're just writing these down. But then it doesn't affect the cash flows because they're non-cash charges, so they're added back to the cash flow statement.
Okay.
They reduce a little bit of their taxes on the income statement with it, but just basically keeping everything on the up and up in terms of what they believe it's worth at the moment. Hmm. This could come from a lot of these acquisitions that you've mentioned. Maybe the acquisition doesn't look as lucrative as it did when they bought it. But that's not saying that the future cash flows won't be there eventually. They just aren't expecting them based on the current environment.
Okay.
So
then what's next?
The assets that they have, right. So when you look at this company, a lot of the oil drillers and producers are just kind of stripping their idle rigs and using parts from those to replace parts on the rigs that they're mm-hmm. actively using. So in my mind, once the market does turn, the orders are going to be almost double what they should be because they're going to have to replace the parts on the idle rigs that they've stripped, and right. they're going to continue to have to replace the parts on the rigs that they're using. So the aftermarket business, which is the highest margin business for NOV, I think that might be the first area you start to see a turnaround.
Well, whenever that turnaround happens.
Yeah, whenever that turnaround happens. Yeah. It's not the biggest segment, but it is the highest margin segment. So maybe right. if you see some revenue in there flatline or start to grow a little bit, maybe that's a leading indicator that drillers are preparing for the another surge in drilling.
All right. Let's keep the bad earnings news going with Yahoo.
Announced
earnings yesterday. The numbers were pretty much in line with analyst estimates. None of them were great. None of them were disasters. I think the big news for the call was, I guess, two parts. First was the turnaround in Yahoo's position that it's going to be open to dividing its core company. In fact, the company stated that a reverse spinoff may be in the works. Jason, again, we've got all these great terms out there for the average folks. What is a reverse spinoff and why the turnaround? Why is that Yahoo's only move right now?
Right. Well, they're just trying to figure out whether they, the question with Yahoo and the value of the actual stock today is, break it down into two parts. Is this the Yahoo side of the equation and the Alibaba side of the equation? Mm-hmm. And so for the longest time, they've talked about spinning off that Alibaba holding in a tax efficient way for shareholders so they can realize that value. What has happened, it's been brought to their attention that actually may not work out you know, on the tax side as they anticipated, or at least they couldn't make any guarantees. So then they're looking at other ways to possibly do this. And so then the conversation is tilted towards, does Yahoo need to figure out a way to spin off or sell their core business? And that's sort of the debate going on right now. And, I mean, any which way you cut it, you know, it all kind of goes back to right now. I mean, you know, Yahoo is facing this issue where they are still unable to grow their revenue line. I mean, when Marissa Mayer took over in 2012, I think everybody was pretty enthusiastic about that. She seemed like she was eager and ready to get in there and make some changes and try some new things. And she's done that. It's just not had a very material impact on the business. I mean, if you look at the revenue side of the equation there, sales have just basically stayed flat all along the way. She's offered some new terminology to kind of, you know, help offer some direction maybe on what their strategy is. Mavens, and so Mavens is the acronym for the focus on mobile, video, native, and social.
I am excited about that.
And while I'm glad that they can recognize that's where the opportunities are, you know, whether they can really capitalize or whether they are capitalizing on those opportunities, I think is arguable at this point. And, you know, we're talking about impairments. They just took a whopper of an impairment themselves this quarter to the tune of you know, over $4 billion. And that, you know, when you see that, that makes you wonder, all of these acquisitions that they've been making, I mean, really, what was the point? I mean, were they good acquisitions? Were you getting a good price? Did they have any value? Do they have any value today? I mean, part of that was related to Tumblr, but a lot of that was related to other little bolt-on acquisitions that they, you know, made throughout the course of her tenure here. And so I think there are enough questions out there, you know, from investors today to say, listen, I mean, we just kind of want to see this thing happen. We want to see some finality here, right, and kind of move on, because Yahoo, the core business, I don't know is necessarily all that attractive of an investment idea. And you know, 4 years, I mean, Marissa Mayer's been there, you know, since 2012. I mean, that is an eternity by Wall Street standards. She, you know, she's obviously a smart and talented woman, but I think that, you know, she's also not a founder of this business, so she doesn't have that sort of same feeling that she has, that sort of ownership maybe that a founder might have. I think that's one of the reasons why we like those founder-led businesses. It's not to say that's the reason to invest, but I think that's sort of a benefit you can get there, is a founder will feel that sense of urgency and will make things priorities. You know, for Yahoo right now, there's a question of whether she really is, you know, the most suitable leader for the company.
She's stuck between this rock and a hard place.
I think she's in an untenable position at this point. I think she has come in there and give it her best shot. But I mean, there are a lot of other avenues out there that are you know, garnering our attention these days, particularly where social is concerned. And you know, I mean, Yahoo does have some core properties that I think still gin up a good amount of traffic. What they need to do is figure out really the best way to monetize that. And they can still exist and be successful. They're probably just not going to be able to grow very big in the process.
If you stripped away the name and some of the terminology, I would think that these results were from an oil company.
Right.
15% layoff of their workforce. $4 billion in impairments.
Yeah. That's just it now. I mean, we know that sales aren't really growing, so they have to start looking into figuring out a way to trim the fat there and make it as lean and profitable an operation as possible.
A very fun story there. Let's actually, you know, let's pick it up a bit. Let's talk about GM here, because we could use some good earnings news. The automaker, the number three biggest automaker in the world, kind of knocked it out of the park this year, Taylor. Recorded net income of $9.7 billion for the year. They boosted their dividend, boosted their buyback plan. GM is just crushing it, and yet shares are down. They're down 13% this past year. Where's the disconnect there?
I don't know. It seems like Ford stock is down quite a bit as well, and some of the other auto manufacturers. They had a pretty decent run from what I can remember up until this past year. I don't know if it's worries that maybe the automotive market is getting overheated, because we have just continued to see record amounts of cars being sold.
Overheated, you see?
he's good. Oh, he's good.
Sneeze that right in there.
Let's go ahead. All right. Trucks, I think, are carrying the day right now.
Yeah.
And I think that's a little farsighted in consumers' minds. I also don't think it's going to last. Oil prices are low. Consumers are thinking, oh, shoot, I can fill up my truck for $30 instead of $60, but lo and behold, maybe a couple of years from now, that's not the case. So you've seen a shift in terms of smaller vehicles returning back to bigger vehicles, but we continue to see record vehicle sales. So I don't know if that was just some caution on the part of investors, but they continue to deliver. And so maybe if they can keep this up, maybe it's a value. But I think that it is a little bit nearing a peak, maybe in terms of auto sales demand.
Right. They've been firing on all cylinders.
Keep it coming. Use their own grossism. No, I think Taylor is onto something there. I mean, I think we have hit peak new automobile season here. I mean, the last 2015 was a great year for GM and for Ford. I mean, together they sold, you know, more than 16 million cars.
Right.
And I mean, that's due to low interest rates. That was due to obviously a lot of older vehicles on the road, and low fuel prices have gotten people out there buying, you know, more SUVs. And that worm does turn, right? I mean, that there will be a point in a couple of years where oil prices are higher, gas prices are higher, and, you know, those of us who own SUVs are going to kind of think, oh, man, you know, it's going to kind of take out a line of credit just to fill my car up. But, you know, so it goes. But I think the point, you know, we see a lot of really attractive financing options out there right now from these new car dealers. And I mean, people are stretching out the lives of these loans 6, 7, 8 years in a lot of cases. And that's one thing if, you know, it's a 6 or 7 year car loan and you're getting it at 0% interest. But a lot of these people that are stretching it out that far don't qualify for that low interest. So they're paying interest rates on that, and they're going to be stuck paying those loans for long periods of time. And, you know, cars don't always live that long, and they tend to need a lot of repairs when they start getting that old. I personally think, you know, I'd be steering away from the Fords and GMs of the world.
Steering away
and look,
from.
See, there you go.
I got him. I got him. All right.
But I would be looking, I think I've said this last week, I'd be looking at something like a CarMax. I think that now is a point in time where, you know, probably a year or two down the road, we're going to start seeing a bit more of an attraction on the CarMax, on the used car side of things. And they really are, you know, a wonderful leader in that space from an experience side. As a matter of fact, I think our man behind the glass there, Dan Boyd, didn't you just recently transact with CarMax?
Yeah.
And was it a good transaction? Well, it was a good experience. For those of you who can't see, he's nodding politely. So, yeah, see, I mean, you know, if you can make that guy smile, and it's not that easy to do, you're probably onto something. So,
Dan's
yeah,
a teddy
I think you're probably
Damn.
Looking at a bit of a tough time here for Ford and GM in the coming years.
All right, let's wrap up. We're running a little bit long, but I actually really wanted to talk about this. Amazon just announced it's going to open up 400 physical bookstores in the next couple of years. Where is this coming from? Why is Amazon the king of killing bookstores? Opening bookstores, and how terrified are you if you're a Barnes & Noble's employee?
I would be more terrified if they somehow figured out a better way to sell them online. when I first saw it, I thought that they were just opening physical stores, not specifically bookstores, so I thought maybe it's a distribution angle to it where they just spread their inventory out across the country. They can sell it in the stores, but if they're not selling it, it's not the biggest deal in the world because they're just going to go in and pluck an item out of the inventory and distribute it within 24 hours to someone local. But this is kind of a head scratcher to me because of the book angle.
Right.
It is a bit counter to maybe what I think a lot of people thought Amazon might be doing. And I mean, as a Kindle lover, I mean, like, I don't like buying physical books anymore just because Kindles are so easy to use. But with that said, I think that Amazon has an opportunity here to probably create an even better experience for readers. Readers tend to be very passionate about the subject, and I think there are plenty of people out there that still really appreciate and enjoy physical books.
Yeah,
I mean,
that's
and
right.
I'm
that's
certain
right.
of it. I mean, and you know, I would just year after year with my kids going to school sponsored book days at Barnes & Noble and whatnot. And you could see the traffic is still there for a lot of the stores. I think that Amazon is probably looking at this as an opportunity to use a lot of the data that they have from all of those digital purchases. I think they have a very good idea of what people like, particularly even, you know, when it comes to geographies. And I think they're also looking at this as an opportunity to go beyond just books, including hardware, Kindles, Kindle Fires, things like that. You know, they've proven they're pretty much no limits as to what they're going to try. And so my suspicion is if they try this, and I know they have one open, you know, they will go all out to make it as good an experience as possible. And I think it probably plays a little bit into the Goodreads acquisition that they made, where they kind of have a community of readers. I think they've learned a lot over the course of developing that Kindle business, and I think they'll probably apply some of those learnings to this.
Absolutely. All right. If you would go to a Amazon bookstore, email us at radio@fool.com. Why? Why would you go to an Amazon bookstore instead of just, you know, your local bookshop or just going on Amazon.com? I don't understand.
Book signings.
You know? Okay.
Book signings. Like Doris Kearns Goodwin would be coming out with a new, I think she just came out with her new LBJ book, man. You get her there for a book signing, man, I bet you people would be coming from all over the place.
All right, give us some more
things. I know I would. I mean, that'd be pretty cool.
All right, Jason Moser, Taylor Muckerman, guys, thanks for being here.
Yes, thank you. Indeed.
As always, people on the program may have interest in the stocks they talk about, and the Motley Fool may have formal recommendations for or against. So don't buy or sell stocks based solely on what you hear. That's it for this edition of Market Foolery. The show is mixed by Dan Boyd. I'm Mark Reif. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.